This is Melissa, and today is the 1st of September, 2024. And I hope that everyone is doing well. There are a few things that I wanted to mention, and the first is that the reading, the talk that we had at the CTTM Book Club on Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, went really well. Frank did a great job. He did a lot of work on his talk and covered a lot of ground. It was astonishing. And he still wants to bring us some other installations, some separate podcasts. It's a very dense chapter that he covered. Chapter 11 was entitled Changing Economic Patterns. And I'll be posting a video of that in a few days as soon as I have time to get that done. Now, I'm also going to be including some visuals here, and I'll make a note of it, try to find some way to bring this to your attention if you're not watching the videos of an updated reading schedule we're doing for the book. Because I put my head together with Andrea and Darren in South Africa, and we would like to complete the book by the end of February, so we thought we would take an approach that would be a bit more like a university class where we had hard set reading assignments. I don't know how well it will go, but chapter 12 and 13 we would like to cover in September. This is The Policy of Appeasement, 1931 to 1936. And chapter 13 is The Disruption of Europe. And then the other chapters and their recording schedule, I'll post a visual that Andrea supplied. And she does a great job with these graphics, so this is appreciated. Now, Darren and I are going to cover together chapter 12 and 13 in September. Well, instead of doing a monthly reading, we're going to have a talk live on Telegram on the 14th of September and another talk on the 28th of September. So that is our schedule, and hopefully we can stick with it. It's fun, but it is a big and it's an impressive book. And I think that I don't want us to get bogged down. The other thing that I wanted to mention and by way of not getting bogged down, is I'm going to regularly post links to an audiobook that is online that's being read. It's a little bit robotic, but it's helpful. I find it helpful to read and listen because I can listen when I'm doing other things, and it's using different parts of your brain, so it really sinks in. So that is Book Club. Where I find myself today is between the real history that I did with Dr. Petra Buskins and the upcoming real history that I'm doing with Nick Hayes from Hayes Reviews next week. And he is someone that has been a good part of the Telegram CTTM Book Club, and he has his own podcast where he reads, I think he hosts two nights a week, and sorry if I got that wrong, but he reads books chapter by chapter, and he does an excellent job, and unfortunately I don't have time to follow along with that, although I have checked it out and it's great. So he and I are going to be discussing Animal Farm. So last week with Petra, I was discussing Desmet's book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, and next week I'll be covering Orwell's Animal Farm with Nick. So it puts you in a frame of mind, and for sure. And I have been thinking a lot about the mass mind and group psychology and the individual. And I did not have as much time to do things related to reading and listening and thinking this week as I wanted to, because a family member needed help with a move and then cleaning their place up to, they had renters already, which is great. That was good for them that they moved and found someone to rent their home. But I cleaned it top to bottom, and that was a big project, and then helped with a few other things. I had to be over there when the plumber came, and et cetera, et cetera. So it was a really busy week for me. But I managed to do a little bit of reading and listening to things. I'll start off by telling you what the Redux is. I stayed in 2007 RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network. That's where I was last week with Alan, and that's where I am again today. So this is the day after Christmas, so you'll hear him referencing the cold and the music that he played, and I might even post a link to the guitar composition and performance that he did for Christmas 2007, since he's talking about it. The title of this episode is Nirvana's Bananas and the Strong Delusion, The Folly of Gods and Wannabes. It's a good talk. You know, the ones for RBN are a little bit shorter, certainly than his blurbs became, but he covers a lot of important ground here for my purposes of what I wanted to talk about. There is a bit of a discussion there, you know, the individual versus the mass mind. And just the, you know, he says it right here, right off the bat. What they're doing to us is creating this big, vast, scientifically controlled society where we're just a bunch of animals that have to be kept in line. And they've trained us, most people, to believe that, in fact, that you're nothing more than a bunch of protoplasm, a freak of nature, an accident. And your betters, the scientific betters, will take care of you because you can't take care of yourself. And that's become the norm now. It's pushed from a thousand directions. It's a mantra. And we've been living through this all our lives, actually. It's just more out in the open. And the whole 9/11 fiasco was simply to get the ball rolling. You always need something on a war scale to push such a vast, united world agenda. That is the talk that is going up. And because he mentioned NAFTA, Mexico, Canada, U.S., and Fortress America, the bringing together of these three countries in a trade agreement, U.S., Mexico, Canada deal. It's the renegotiation of NAFTA. What I've noticed is they like to keep you confused by changing the names of things and so forth. But at one point, this was called Fortress America regularly. And I noticed when I typed in Fortress America that all that comes up is a board game where the United States is invaded by three world powers in the 21st century. It said this is a Milton Bradley board game that came out in 1986. So, you know, what comes first, the board game or the concept that they use in the so-called real world? But I found one article from July that I am going to post from the Financial Times. It's entitled, Blocking China's Mexican Backdoor into Fortress America. So it took me a little while to dig and find this actually used in conjunction with a trade agreement. It said Washington has to keep acting to maintain its trade and tech barriers against Beijing. This has to do with U.S. politics and saying we're, you know, not going to let China take over. The writer uses a Leonard Cohen line but changes it. It says there's a crack in everything. That's how Chinese imports get in. as the Biden administration's time in office has proceeded, so its determination not to let its economy be infiltrated, and that often feels like the right word, by Chinese goods, has had to adapt. So what they're pointing out is that no matter what goes on with U.S. politics and China, China exports to Mexico, Mexico brings things in under USMCA, you see? And of course, that's how it was always designed to be. So I will post that from a couple of days ago, two or three days ago, from the New York Times, at least 10 killed. That number's gone up now. But at least 10 killed as Israel begins major military operation in West Bank. So this article, unfortunately, I did not save it when it was first published on August 28, because it was updated on the 30th, and they've changed it a little bit. It said hundreds of troops entered cities in the occupied territory targeting Palestinian militants. It was a significant escalation after months of raids that have unfolded alongside the war in Gaza. When this was first published on the 28th, about the second or third paragraph down, it was saying that this added to further immiserate the Palestinians. That was the word they used. So they said this operation has been a further immiseration for the Palestinians. So just in case you want to learn a new word, immiserate is to make miserable, impoverish, to impoverish or sink into misery in the verb form. One thing that I read was that the UN aid agencies were not delivering aid, and they had stopped at a certain point for fear of getting into crossfire and so forth. But this is just from earlier today. It said that the polio vaccine campaign begins in the Gaza Strip. It said deaths rise in Gaza and West Bank attacks as a polio vaccine campaign begins in the Gaza Strip. So there you go. I guess everybody's just trying to do what they can about that immiseration. The individual in this has a difficult, almost impossible task. And when I was talking with Petra, I said, Alan said that he was not here for the masses. The masses were his enemy. And yet, he would sometimes talk about decent people. These are, I never use the word normies, but If I use that, you'll know what I'm talking about. There are decent people there. I will just say one who is part of the mass mind. Alan recognized that, but it's a little bit like that concept from the movie The Matrix. As long as they are in their programming, they truly are your enemy. And I was thinking about who is hypnotizable and who is not, what is the individual, and so on. I stumbled on the work of wanting to listen to psychologists talk about the mass mind and group psychology and totalitarianism. I stumbled on a podcast on the American Psychological Association website, and it was entitled Speaking of Psychology, Crowds, Obedience, and the Psychology of Group Behavior with Stephen Reicher, PhD. Now, he is at St. Andrews University in Scotland, and he discussed with an American psychologist who was hosting it why mob mentality is a myth and other misconceptions about crowd behavior, the role of leaders in groups, and what can we learn from re-examining some classic psychology studies on obedience to authority, and what we've learned about leaders, followers, group identity, and collective behavior from the COVID-19 pandemic. So I was listening to this, and he had a disagreement with the classic work on crowd psychology that was done in the late 19th century by Gustave Le Bon, The Crowd. He said that crowds don't work like that. He said what you have with a crowd is that you have a gathering of individuals who don't so much lose their individuality in the crowd, but they suspend it for the time that they have willingly chosen to be a part of that mass for whatever reason it comes together. I mean, think about a football game or whatever. So he said it's a willing suspension of individuality. Well, I returned again to Alan's thinking about how rare the individual is. And I was also thinking about Carl Jung's idea of individuation. You know, Jung's basically saying, without going too deep into it, you must venture deeply into yourself to truly individuate from the mass mind, because it is part of the family structure and the religious structure and so forth. I mean, we are born into this, and this is where we stay, according to Alan, until we do an incredible amount of work to become individuals. So I was basically just thinking that this fellow, Stephen Reicher, was just rubbishy. I'm like, yeah, I don't like that. So I looked him up, and lo and behold, Stephen Reicher was part of SAGE. Now, I was not able to follow their inquiries after COVID too closely, but you will all remember Alan talking about SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, who advised the British government. And he also posted an article that was from June of 2020, and he reposted it several times, and I've reposted it several times. So this is, we've put it up in various places on the website at least half a dozen times, possibly 10. How SAGE and the UK media created fear in the British public. So again, this is June 2020. It said COVID-19 started registering with most of the British public around late February and early March. Many were concerned, but not particularly afraid. Only weeks later, people were terrified to leave their homes or go near other human beings. How did such a dramatic shift in public perception happen so quickly? In early March 2020, the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE, produced a document for the UK government highlighting methods for rolling out new social distancing rules. There seemed to be some doubt as to whether the public would comply with the upcoming measures, so SAGE outlined a methodology based on known psychological behavioral modification techniques. Now, I will post this and you can look at it, but there were several groups within SAGE, these subgroups, and one of them I'm going to focus on called SPIB, Independent Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Behaviors. That's SPIB. If you follow up on this, this did actually end up being part of a panel, and those of you in the UK or who want to follow it closely will be able to uncover quite a few articles. I'm just going to go to one, and before it was reviewed, it ultimately was. This is from 2021 in The Telegraph. Role of SAGE to be reviewed over fears that scientists hold too much power. You think? Here is the list of participants of SAGE. Now, this is early on. This is the overview. This is from the UK government website. And it said, Sage first met in response to COVID-19 on 22 January 2020. It has been grateful for insights from a huge range of sources. At high pace, experts from academic, public sector, industrial, and commercial communities have provided the high-quality research and information used to formulate advice given to government. And then they go on and list the participants. And I will provide this link. You can see who the participants are in the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. And if you scroll down that page, you'll find that subgroup that I'm talking about, the Scientific Pandemic Insights Group on Behavior, SPI-B. And if you scroll down a little bit more, oh, wow, there you're going to find Professor Stephen Reicher, University of St. Andrews. Interestingly, almost immediately after that first publication of what you might call the fear tactics, another group sprung up. I believe that their first posting on their site was in April of 2020. So the first recommendations are made to the UK government March of 2020, and then this group called Indie_Sage. So Indie Sage has their first publications up in April of 2020. Who's a part of Indie Sage? Well, there again we find Stephen Reicher. So here they say, Independent Sage is a group of scientists who are working together to provide independent scientific advice to the UK government and public on how to minimize deaths and support Britain's recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. We believe openness and transparency leads to better understanding and better decision-making. And we also believe that the responsibility of scientists and those with specialist knowledge to engage with the public and policymakers for the benefit of all, blah, blah, blah. So what they're saying and they're about is that they're not affiliated with the government, right? So already, whatever transpired there in the early days, it became clear to some that they needed to distance themselves. But the mentality of the technocrat, and that's what I'm going to say, the mentality of the technocrat, the expert, is still very palpable when you look at the publications on Indie Sage. What I'm saying is there aren't really independent thinkers represented here. There aren't medical or scientific professionals with a different narrative. In other words, it is groupthink. So I persevered. I listened to the entire 47 minutes and some seconds of Stephen Reicher speaking with this American psychologist, as he said that it is not just a mindless, hypnotized, unthinking mass mind, but it is a collective of individuals who have just set aside, just put their own individuality on hold for the sake of whatever the group is doing when they come together. But there were lots of interesting things. By this time, I'd already looked him up, so I really knew. I had seen the rat, and now I just wanted to see how the rat was going to convince us that he was a friendly rat. And he said things like when he was shooting down Laban's work on the crowd, and he wasn't impugning the work of Hannah Arendt and the banality of evil, but it was just like, oh, well, we know more. We've moved on from that. And he has a lot of what he says are original studies. And one thing that he has done is looked at Stanley Milgram's experiments. You know, we all have, those of us who've listened to Alan for a long time know about these Milgram experiments and the book that came out of that, Obedience to Authority. And the setup of this experiment essentially is that They get people off the street, common average people, and they tell them that they are part of an important scientific experiment, very important, and that the things that they learn from this experiment will help scientists save lives. Really, really important work that they're doing. But they tell them that they have to generate these shocks on the participants. They're in another room, but they can hear the sounds of them screaming or reacting to being shocked. And of course, all of this is it's a setup with actors and so forth. But the people who are administering the shocks, he said, it's not so much that they were, he said, what you're really seeing is not a study that shows you obedience to authority, but you're seeing a study that shows you obedience and disobedience to authority. And he gives the percentages what happened. He said also Stanley Milgram ran this experiment approximately 30 times, and each time he ran it, he used a slightly different set of parameters so that a group would come together. They would be in a what looked like a really nice, well-kept laboratory, and they would be told that they're participating in something important for humanity. And there the study shows that approximately, I believe, I'm going from memory here, but approximately 30% of the participants objected, didn't agree to obey authority. But then they ran the experiments in kind of like dingy places that were kind of dingy and dark and dirty. And the people who were hosting the experiment were sloppy. They didn't have the white lab coat on. It just looked thrown together. And in that batch of experiments, then you had closer to like 50% disobedience. So the point that Reicher was making is, it's the leader that matters. It's who the authority is that determines whether or not we will obey that authority. So if the authority is wearing the white lab coat and everything is clean and sterile and it looks scientific, then people go along in greater numbers. But if it's, kind of a haphazard setup and, so you get where I'm going with this. But a point that Reicher made to the host that he was speaking with was that all of this mattered. Reevaluating group psychology, reevaluating the crowd, the mob, the mass, the mob mentality. It mattered because it's a nuance, but what you're seeing is people come together in a group and they willingly set aside their individuality for the aims of the group. And he said this was so instructive and important in something like COVID-19. We needed to have a lot more team, that we needed it to be we, as in we're all in it together. We needed to get the I out of there. Stephen Reicher is, he's a player, and he is coming from a place that I simply, I don't have any psychological training, but based on my own experience and my own observations, I concur with Alan. The individual, the truly individuated person, is much less common than we would like to think. I think that factors in hugely into who is susceptible to fear campaigns, who is more susceptible to propaganda, who is more likely to bow to the white lab coat. And so it's very important to be an individual. It's worth it to look at the man and the woman in the mirror and say, who am I in this situation? I also today looked at a lot of interesting things about technocracy. I mean, this was I don't have it right in front of me, but I do have it right in front of me, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. What I don't know is if I have it bookmarked. And I don't seem to. Anyway, Quigley was talking about the... Here it is. This is on page 38, where Quigley lays out the kinds of capitalism when they started the manorial system going all the way back to the year 670. Then you've got commercial capitalism, industrial capitalism, financial capitalism, which he says lasted from 1850 to 1932, and then monopoly capitalism, which starts to show up in places in 1899. And yes, there he says it's phased out by 1950. And then he describes something that would have been at the time of publication what they were still in, what he calls the pluralist economy, 1934 to the present. And the type of organization would be lobbying groups, and the management would be technocrats. So I looked into pluralist economy, and that was going to go down into an economic rabbit hole that I did not have time for. I was simply wanting to find more about what Quigley defined as the management class there, the technocrats. And we know that you've got Technocracy Inc. Elon Musk's maternal grandfather was high up there in Canada's Technocracy Inc. We know we've heard about Patrick Wood and technocracy, and so we understand a little bit about technocracy and scientific socialism. Rule by experts, rule by the scientific class, the engineers, they are our managers. But once I did that dive into technocracy, it was fascinating to me to find that this has been written about for, probably a long time, but for the last, say, decade and a half, technocracy as it ties into philosophy, as it ties into political systems, as it ties into economic systems, has been very well covered, defended, and criticized. So whatever Quigley was thinking about when he used that term, I think it would probably have been a narrower view than the technocracy that has been widely exposed by people like Patrick Wood. But when looking into this, I just want to share a find with you that I obviously haven't had time to read because I just found it today. But I'm always looking for people that I think are talking about things that really, really matter. And, you know, like I said, I've got that spidey sense, you know, I try not to go, oh, controlled opposition and gatekeeper and so forth, but I'm still cautious. And I know that I won't say names or anything, but Alan has shared people with you in the past where he's put up a link or two of their work and then discovered something about them. And he didn't come out and make a disclaimer on it or retract the link on the website or anything like that. He just didn't talk about them again, and he didn't post their work again. And I've sort of decided that I need to take the same approach. So there have been things that I've shared with you that later I learn a bit more about the person, and I think, that's not that good. So I, you know, making that disclaimer here, I came upon the work of someone that I had not heard of before by the name of David A. Hughes, and he's an academic in England. And he wrote a book called COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. And I subsequently stumbled on a very brief, it was obviously an excerpt of an interview that he had done with Catherine Austin Fitz. And I liked what he was saying. So the little bit of scanning that I've done, I'm going to go ahead and share this with you. Like I say, if I get down the road here on this and, you know, don't like something, well, then that'll be the last time I mention him. But I think that the book is worth sharing because the mass mind, whatever Reicher, you know, says, the mass mind is real. We are not as... many of us are individuals, but we find ourselves in social situations with people that we love that aren't individuals, that are part of the mass mind. See? So they may not be actively our enemy, but they are potentially so because they are inclined to go along with whatever the groupthink or the mass mind of their particular social structure is. I can take it close to home. I was going to tell you a story a couple of weeks ago. I kept having cat interruptions because they think I exist only to play with them. When they're in the mood to play, I better be too. And I have to try to round them up, wrangle the cats, and put them in a different part of the house so that they don't come in meowing. And so a couple of weeks ago, I had started to tell you the story of taking my Aunt Betty to the doctor. And I started off like four times, and I had to stop the recording because of cat interruptions. And finally I said, well, it's just not meant to be. I'm not supposed to share that story with you. But I'm going to tell you anyway. I had taken her to the ENT and thinking this might be an inner ear thing. It turns out that that is likely not what it is that has been making her dizzy. And she had a bunch of tests there. And I happened to know the doctor because of family connections and so forth. And that, of course, always makes it nicer. And he was very kind and helpful and suggested some further blood tests and so forth. But when we left his office, after a completely good experience of being well treated by everyone there, and we were walking out to the car, my Aunt Betty started to cry. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I'm just a useless old woman." And I said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. Why would you say something like that?" And she said, I'm sick. I'm not good for anything." And as it turned out, Alan talked about that 2 weeks ago, you know, how we throw people away and, you know, euthanasia, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't want the state making that decision because sometimes people, even when they're very ill, they might want those few extra weeks or even days to be with loved ones and deal with the things that they need to psychologically, spiritually. So I did what I usually do when, you know, I was the clown, and I just told her that she was not useless, and then I started the clowning, and I took us out for tacos, and we had a frozen yogurt, and, you know, she was in a much better mood almost immediately, and I had her laughing, and I make up silly songs that really crack her up, and so that, you know, we ended up saving her mood. And as I was driving out of that town to return to ours, just driving through the town, and there's a woman walking on the street, you know, like a foot and a half into the street, and she's right next to a sidewalk. There's a sidewalk that ran the whole length there, but she's walking on the street. And I said to Aunt Betty, I said, that woman is walking on the street when there's a sidewalk right there that she could walk on. I think she must be a half-wit. And without missing a beat, Aunt Betty said, oh, honey, it would take three more just like her to make a half-wit. Well, I just howled with laughter. That just cracked me up, the speed and the wit that she displayed there. And I laughed and we had a good time and that was that. But what I'm saying is that in all of the ways that I think it matters in being an individual, my Aunt Betty is not what you would call individuated. She is completely defined by her family, her siblings that she was close to, that she's now lost, her various roles, a mother, a sister, a daughter, a grandmother, a great-grandmother. She is then a member of her church and a member of the town, and then she's a member of her political party, and then she's an American. You know, it goes out the groups that define her, but she's very much a group kind of person, a mass mind person. But I love her tremendously, and she has, see what I'm saying there, this decency, humor, love, and compassion that can be displayed by who could potentially be your enemy, because my Aunt Betty believes everything she hears on the news. You see what I'm saying? So it's the way of the individual, as I was discussing with Petra, is a very narrow path that we make our way in. We're surrounded, we're in situations where, as I said a couple of months back, I feel like I'm a stranger in a strange land. And this is all the time with me. But what is more important in identifying the structure of the groups that then become our enemies, I don't think it's just the mindless mob. I think there's something to the idea that the mob, the mass, the crowd, is always, in that way Reicher gets it right, they're always revolving around the core, and the core is a leader. There's always a leader. It may be appointed from outside the group. It may be infiltrated. It may be controlled. It may be the gatekeeper. But there are people or persons that we could identify as keeping that group cohesive. And I think that as individuals sitting outside those groups, although we sometimes intersect with them, those are the people that we have to be very aware of. And just because someone is saying they're all about medical freedom or they're all about this or that, that does not make them an individual in the sense that we think of it. They may well be our enemy. So there's so much caution that we're all having to exhibit now in our interactions with people. I was thinking about Plato and his writing about the masses, and here's a quote from him. It said, those who are able to see beyond the shadows, this is Plato's cave, right? That concept. Those who are able to see beyond the shadows and lies of their culture will never be understood, let alone believed by the masses. I think that that is important because the mass mind cuts across all strata of society. So your academic, your professional, they may be likelier to be part of the mass mind than the blue-collar worker or the woman that serves you coffee at the coffee shop. because they have a tendency to want to conform to the norms of the group, whatever the intellectual currency of the day is. Well, I think that just about wraps it up for me, and I wish you all a really good week. Thanks.
I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on December the 26th, 2007. I always ask newcomers to look into the website, cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and here we are, just coming through the midwinter crisis, as we call it. This is a time when you view the past with sorrow and the future with dismay, as Othello would have said, because we seldom ever really try and achieve that which we set out to do. And the older you get, of course, you have sorrow because, or dismay because, you know you're getting too old to actually try and fulfill any ambitions. That's why it's best to really do it at the time. Don't postpone it. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And unfortunately, on the big scale of things, we do know what's going to happen tomorrow because they keep telling us what they're doing to us. And what they're doing to us is creating this big, vast, scientifically controlled society where we're just a bunch of animals that have to be kept in line. And they've trained us, most people, to believe that, in fact, that you're nothing more than a bunch of protoplasm, a freak of nature, an accident, and your betters, the scientific betters, will take care of you because you can't take care of yourself. And that's become the norm now. It's pushed from 1,000 directions. It's a mantra. And we've been living through this all our lives, actually. It's just more out in the open. And the whole 9/11 fiasco was simply to get the ball rolling. You always need something on a war scale to push such a vast united world agenda. We used to wonder, some of my friends years ago, how they would pull this off. It was easy enough to see how they would unify Europe. And with the US, they've been having a little detente with Canada and Mexico for years, getting all prepared. But we wondered how they would really pull it off, and they're using this terrorism nonsense to ram through the unification of the Americas, Fortress America, they call it. And for the Far East, they're doing the same thing there. Every country on the planet almost has signed the same anti-terrorism laws into effect. This never happened in world wars, this kind of cooperation. And the reason it never happened in world wars is it didn't have all the advanced planning and interweaving of bureaucracies that bypass governments to bring it about. Do you realize it takes donkey's years? Donkey's a long time, by the way. But it takes donkey's years for bureaucrats to get anything out of their minds and onto paper. Never mind get it all planned out and legislated. Back with more after these messages. I'm Alan Watt, back cutting through the matrix and just pointing out to people things which they take for granted. Most people don't really think critically in much depth, especially when they've been trained that the media is there to do all their thinking for them, and that has been successful with most people. Bureaucracies and federal governments don't move quickly on things. They're too big and heavy, too many departments and divisions that all cross each other's lines and step on each other's toes. It takes a lot of planning when it comes to an international scale, and the reason that they're so able in this day and age to bring out a global system is because they planned it a long time ago and set up the bureaucracies, which are almost secret societies within the government themselves, these high state departments and departments of the Foreign Office, as they have in the British Commonwealth countries. They're pretty well secretive, and they work intergenerationally. H.G. Wells talked about this when the League of Nations, which was the embryo for the United Nations, when the League of Nations came into being. And he said, for the first time, he said, now a bureaucracy in one country can bypass government and go directly to its counterpart in another country or to the League of Nations. And therefore, technically, governments were becoming obsolete. And he was quite right, because that was the intention of setting this up, that the Punch and Judy show that we have, the left and the right circus act that we get every so often, would no longer be necessary, because to train a public, literally train them, that they were being taken care of, and that's where a world run by experts would come into play. And that was the mantra back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s, a world of experts, until we don't know how to get up out of the bed in the morning and dress ourselves without the expert telling us how to dress and what kind of weather it's going to be. That's how bad it has literally become. The common sense is out the window, and no one has any faith in themselves anymore. We're terrified to think and to work on what we think. That's not by chance either, because individuality is the enemy of this totalitarian system. It was stated long ago that the individual is the one person, an individual with understanding and with the ability to get across to people what's really happening. That was a tremendous danger. The masses are not the danger, because the masses are always asleep. They take the culture that's been infused into them without thinking. And they'll think amongst themselves that they're choosing, but they're not really. They're given a select amount of things to choose from, and religions as well to choose from, including the New Age. There's a whole variety within there for different personality types. But really, your choices are limited, and most people float through life in an almost semi-hypnotic state, parroting little phrases and going through routines, as they're called, which they think is their own personal way of being, their own individuality. And in reality, it's simply a type of suit that you've bought from a one-size-fits-all, and that's the one that you like. You've chosen something that's been offered to you. And that's how most people are. Individuals are the enemy to the system. It's all groupthink. And this was pushed heavily, tremendously heavily, through the very methods that Carol Quigley talked about when he mentioned the new feudal system being run by CEOs and corporations internationally. The big corporations were the first ones to put out this term called team spirit, until it became the mantra again, another mantra that went through all the big executive offices. And team player was the big term they used. Are you a team player? Everybody suddenly had to be a team player. And they sent them off to these encounter courses and a whole bunch of names for the same thing, really, to give them more abilities to get what they wanted, to be more aggressive in their sales, etc., if they work in sales. But the first thing they learned was to give up their ability to work alone, independence. And they'd tell them that two people that were behind you, just close your eyes and fall back, an idea being that these people would catch you. And that was to get you used to the fact that you were only part of a team. You didn't need independence anymore. And they reinforced this with every little trick that they gave to the candidates that they brought in for these training courses. And they came out being team players, and yet all thinking they were individuals, they could get what they wanted, just think and grow rich and all this kind of stuff. Well, I think if you were asked, Donald Trump, it takes more than thinking to grow rich. It needs to know, you have to know the right friends, the right people. And you have to use a lot of payola. It's called payola. Payola is a strange sort of money that changes hands surreptitiously under tables and things like that, or through middlemen. That's how you get ahead in this world. And even then, you can't get up there unless the big boys at the top open the door and bring you in. That's how it works. It's just like free trade. There's no such thing as free trade. It's simply an easier trade for the big corporations. The small businesses are out of the picture. They can't get permits to sell their stuff under the guise of free trade. It's a cornering of the market for a select few. That's the reality. And they use double speak all the time to get their way. a big system steamrolling ahead using Pavlov's tricks and training us all in a scientific fashion from kindergarten. I understand someone was telling me before the weekend that now there's children getting taken into pre-daycare courses pretty well. It's pre-kindergarten at the age of 6 weeks, and this is a new step, which is closer to the step that Huxley and others talked about, and Bertrand Russell even talked about in his early days. They thought they were following Plato's old plan, where in the perfect world state, the plebs, or plebeians, as they called the commoners, would all be reared and never know their mothers and fathers. The child would be removed from the mother at birth. That was to be the perfect system they'd bring in, because they didn't want parents to contaminate the child's head with old-fashioned ideas, like bonding and stuff like that. You know, familial bonding was to be out of the picture, and the world state would be your boss. You'd worship Big Brother. But then they found out with experimentation that they could do the same thing with scientific indoctrination if they would get the child young enough in kindergarten. It wouldn't matter then what the parents said in the evenings or at night to the child. It would just go right through their head and wouldn't attach. And the state would give the morals to the children. Well, that's already happened. Not only has it already happened, in a span of only 20 years with government-paid daycare in some countries like Canada, when the daycares, people go on strike or go slow or whatever, the women in the streets, working women are in the streets with their banners demanding that the government do something. Well, see, they've already adapted to the fact that somehow the government is their husband. He's taken over the role of the husband and should take care of their children for them. They really believe that. I can remember when they had debates about should government have any involvement whatsoever in the affairs of the people when it came to children. But now it's an expected thing. It's been successful. So it's only a matter of time, of course, before government mandates that they'll choose who can even have children and by what method you'll be inseminated for a short period of time till again into the pure cloning types. That's coming too. And meanwhile, what's happening with all of those in the middle class and the ones who think they have a better education? Well, they've gone through all these self-help courses and they're into the new age completely, and they refuse to look at the bad news because that's negative. And they've been taught that only look at the positive side of things. Well, some of the things like getting killed off because there's too many of you, it's kind of hard to be positive about, especially if you might be the one that's going to get killed off amongst the many. But somehow they have the ability through ego to believe that they'll miss me. They don't mean me. They mean all those guys, but not me. I'm special. I'm a very special person. I'm superior. And I guess that's what they all think as they float around and rattle their chakras and chant talk about all their... They have religious ways of speaking in the New Age, no different from any other religion. And they think somehow they created it all, but they didn't create any of it. It was all created for them. Because the New Age is meant to bring them in to a world... It's a big group again, no individuals, you're all members of a particular group, New Agers, and you'll all become one. And they're teaching them through all these courses. They're all run by the intelligence agencies, by the way. That's who brought them to the West and pushed them, and the big foundations finance them. They're teaching them that they're going into this beautiful new kind of nirvana, and only the fit ones will come through. It's straight out of Hinduism, you see. A whole lot was copied from Hinduism. And each one of them who've paid all their courses and stood on their head and chanted their mantras and so on, and found out how many past lives they had and how much debt they have owing in karma, each one thinks that they're one of them are going to come through and be saved in this new nirvana, while the rest, you know, the rubbish heap, disappears and gets killed off. That's what they're being taught from every type of New Age source. That's the mantra. And just talking about how how everything is guiding the planet and people on the planet through this something wonderful. That's the term they use. Something wonderful is going to happen. Now, that was a term that Arthur C. Clarke used in 2001 and 2010. Something wonderful is going to happen. And that's the term that the New Agers are given to. Something, they're not sure what it is, except each one of them, because I've paid for all these courses. And it's amazing the class distinction within them too, because the ones who pay the more expensive gurus think that they're, it's like buying your way into nirvana. No different from the old church system, where you could pay in advance and you get more prayers said for you and all that, and you could work your way up through heaven much quicker. It's the same techniques that are used, because it's all based on fear, and people who go into these religions tend to live in a form of fear. Fear of the unknown. The idea being that you can overcome fear of the unknown by gaining special powers and becoming a god. Becoming a god, you see, you can become God, the God within. And if you're really, really good and get good gurus, you can take shortcuts and become a god all the quicker. And then go on to see your dentist and your doctor and all the rest of it. And if you're a god and you can't cure yourself, well, what's your doctor and your dentist? They must be super gods. But there's no logic involved. It's not meant to be logical. It's meant to appeal to those people who want no rules. So funny, really, because they're the most easygoing people to be controlled by the powers that be, because they won't look at what the leader are doing to them. You're not supposed to look at the negative, the bad, nasty things, all those downers. They look at the positive things and do a lot of smiling and use all the New Age terminology, like all religionists tend to do. And they've all had their little experiences, and they talk about their dreams, and generally it's too much caffeine that causes their dreams. And I'm not kidding about that, too. I've had people who've called me before who've had nightmare after nightmare, and I ask them if they drink coffee late in the evening, and they do. And I told them, I said, do you realize they modified the coffee bean over 10 years ago? It's one of the first things they modified. And why not? Because they went for the things that commonly are taken on a daily basis by the majority of people, tea and coffee. Then they went into all the foods that you eat. Now, I can remember reading in the paper, and I think it was in the Toronto Sun, about 10 years ago, in the business pages, which I was just flicking through because I was, had nothing else to do that day. And it said that the purchasers who have the real power and anything to do with food, the purchasers had got together and demanded that the growers use the modified shrubs, or they wouldn't buy their coffee. And I thought, well, why? I mean, the growers were not complaining about a poor turnover or bad crops or even prices. They weren't complaining. So there had to be another reason for it. And they have. They've modified the coffee. And people really do have tremendous dreams with them. Some of them like them. They have journeys, they call them. But they don't call them dreams, they have journeys. And some have kind of exciting ones, other ones have nightmares. But it's just amazing how the New Agers fall into all of this stuff. And I always tell people to go into Huxley's speech, which is on my website for download. You can get the audio there in the audio archives, where Huxley talked at Berkeley about 60% of the public in all ages being instantly suggestible, meaning hypnotics, and 20% more can be brought under the same state of influence with a little bit more work on behalf of the controllers, and another 20% are left that it's much, much harder to bring under. And that's how most things work in religion, including the New Age religion. It's suggestion, tremendous suggestion. And the will, the need to believe in it, that's how most things happen. There's a need to believe in something bigger than yourself. With the goal to be a god yourself is quite interesting. But these are people who are ignorant generally of the sources of their religions. They don't know the powers that went behind the scenes to create such a religion and such a movement in the 1800s in London. That's where it started. And who they even put out there, the actresses and actors they hired and trained, to go out there and propagate this religion into being, which took 100 years to really get rolling. And now is heavily financed by the usual guys, the big foundations. They pay for their magazines and everything. Very interesting history. When you go into Blavatsky and you read the books by Blavatsky's sister and others and investigative reporters at the time who went into the real Blavatsky, and even her sister said she was a born actress. She used to enthrall her own age group from a childhood onwards by telling them stories and fascinating them. So she was a really good actress, and that's who they employed to bring it forth, all Blavatsky. And here we are 100-odd years later, watching it all around us. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it all comes in with greening too, the greening of the planet. At one time when you got green, you were sick to the gills. And we have Gary from Canada on the phone. Are you there, Gary?
Hi, Alan. How are you?
Not so bad.
Thanks for shining a light down the rabbit hole here, helping me put the puzzle pieces together.
That's quite an interesting journey, isn't it, going through this this system here that people think just evolved out of nowhere spontaneously by the people themselves.
Quite the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Wow. Yep. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, I want to ask you about the symbol of the spider.
Mm-hmm.
I'd recently come across an artist named Louise Bourgeois, and she created these giant spiders.
Oh, yeah, that's the ones that got in The Hague.
Exactly.
There's one in The Hague. I think Canada also brought one in for the museum.
On permanent display. It's in Canada. The permanent display is in Spain, Korea, Tokyo, outside of their national galleries. And this, now, she created a series of six giant spiders. Mm-hmm. The standing one, she got standing and crouching, but the standing one was 9 meters, 30 feet tall.
Yep.
It's made of bronze, stainless steel, and marble, which is a steel and rock.
Yep.
And has an egg sac of 30 eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given the name Mammon. I spell M-A-M-A-N.
Yeah.
If there's any interesting numbers.
Boy, that's interesting because in masonry, the number 8, apart from being above and below the two eternal circles, is also the symbol for power and money. Mm-hmm. And so 8's very important, the 8 legs of the spider.
Okay.
And the Black Widow, of course, they're all widows' sons. All these guys in the elite high masonry call themselves widows' sons. And these big monstrosities that they put in The Hague and so on, apparently there's clusters of eggs underneath them, meaning offspring. And it's a symbol for a new system coming into play. A system where humankind will be radically altered, because the Black Widow also eats the mate after she's conceived. You'll notice that men are becoming rather irrelevant now. You know, there's pieces, articles in newspapers now where they can actually take female stem cells and so on and create the Y chromosome, so they're claiming it in a way at least. And some women have had this done, and you call that vanity, having a complete offspring, a clone of yourself. There's quite the prize for a complete egomaniac to have someone who's completely narcissistic. So it's got high symbols to do with a new system and the eradication of the old male as well. Power and money. It's got 8 legs. It is power and money, and it's got a cluster of eggs for a new species to become widow's sons. Yeah.
And would the spider's web matrix, could that be considered like the spider's web?
Yeah, that's why we've got the web, and we have the net and the web. That's the both things for us all being interconnected, and you're stuck on it because it's the only system that's going to allow to exist. Eventually, it'll do away with paper mail altogether. You know?
Would that be like the sticky gooey stuff on the web would be what we'd call like fascination, intrigue, mystery?
There's no doubt. It was designed to intrigue. I know people who are addicted to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely addicted. In fact, some of them almost kill themselves night and day just surfing the web. It's like one big roller coaster for them, and they get a rush just zipping through it. they are already addicted because they're ready. A lot of people are ready to go into this alternate reality, another New Age term, the alternate reality. But they don't question the fact that someone programmed this reality and it wasn't them.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Take care.
So yeah, you're dealing with a system, a complete system that gives us everything for control. They'd never give you anything for your benefit, and it might actually empower you. So they give you something that will eventually be part of the complete world monitoring system. Now, we've also got Rick in California there. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I'm here, Alan.
How are you?
Good. Thank you very much for your guitar piece last night. That was very beautiful.
You got it. Yeah.
Yeah, I really liked that a lot. It was very beautiful, Alan. Can I read two paragraphs out of a magazine I bought? This is from American Interest. It's a Policy, Politics, and Culture. It's edited by Walter Russell Mead and Zygmunt Brzezinski. It's one of the think tank papers. And this article is called "Self-Made Man" by Richard Hayes, and he's talking about this British John Harris, a member of the United Kingdom's Human Genetics Advisory Committee and the Ethics Committee of the British Medical Association. And he says, Harris continues by arguing that the genetic enhancement of the human species is a public good, since those who might choose to remain genetically unmodified will benefit from the economic, social, and cultural vitality that an increasingly genetically engineered citizenry will impart. He reasons that just as we compel citizens to ensure that their children are educated and vaccinated, so we might we compel people to have children who are genetically enhanced. He acknowledges that a period of experimentation will be required in order to perfect such procedures. Accordingly, he says, people are obligated to serve as research projects for genetic experiments when needed. This includes children because, and this is his words, if children are moral agents, and most of them, except very young infants, are, then they have both obligations and rights, and it will be difficult to find any obligations that are more basic than the obligation to help others in need. There is therefore little doubt that children share the obligation argued for in this chapter to participate in medical research. So they're getting more honest about eugenics and everything.
Oh, yeah. They put out a movie years ago called Gattaca, about a very near future where there'll be two separate species of humans, the ones who are genetically enhanced, who would get all the best jobs, and those that were the old type, that were conceived in the old-fashioned way, and how inferior they were. It's all about that. It's creating new classes or castes of systems within society, and that's their goal. Bertrand Russell talked about that in the 30s. He says eventually there'll be two classes of people, and the ruling class will have a completely separate education from the plebeians at the bottom. That's all coming into play. It's already here, actually, that part of it. So the genetic enhancement is a done deal. They want to dumb down most people. They'll enhance you in certain ways to make you a better worker, but you will be incapable of thinking independently as a separate human being. They'll make sure of that. You'll be very, very good, very efficient at the work that they're giving you or you're assigned to, but you will not be an independent-minded thinker at all.
Yes, it goes back to what you were saying before. Like when you said they'll make Dachau sound like Disneyland, and this guy is making what Mengele did sound like Disneyland.
Yes, Mengele was quite the character. I mean, he collected blue eyeballs. That was his hobby. And they're all much the same. It's the same character as in charge at the top. They're sadistic psychopaths who have strange fascinations of the macabre, and they're running the show. They're paid lots of money to do all this experimentation. But I do hope people get that through their heads, that the elite have already said that this will not create the main problem they're trying to avoid, and that's independent thinkers with high intellect. Their whole job is to cull off those with high intellect. That was also part of their agenda. Russell talked about that in a talk. I read it from his blurb last night. I put on my blurb what Russell said about that. So, you'll be very, very efficient, but you'll be more like the Borg than an actual sentient human being.
Yeah, I just wanted to put that out there, Alan. And they're also talking about like the third Kosovo war. We're going to have Clinton again. We're going to have Kosovo again. It's going to be like... There's all kinds of, There's a lot of articles coming out now. I just wanted to share that one with you, Alan, and maybe I'll send it to you when I'm done reading it. So.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and have a happy holiday season. So.
And you too.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Yep, and that's the world that we're getting trained in too, and it's all around us. And we'll be overwhelmed with all the little disclosures in newspapers and magazines, all pointing the same way, because as I say, most folk have induced beliefs. They have no beliefs of their own. It's induced beliefs. They take it almost by osmosis, and they start parroting the phrases and so on, and they become what they're meant to become through this induction without questioning it. And that's where we're going today. I know that even 15 years ago, certain ones in India were paying big, big bucks for genetic manipulation of their offspring, very high Brahmins, and it was being done already there. And there's your problem again with humanity. You can't either leave them as they are and leave things to work out the way they are with children born in a normal way and take your chances. Or you go in, see, people are addicted to shopping. In the Western civilization, they're actually addicted to shopping. And it wouldn't be hard in that kind of culture, which is the total culture, really, it's a commercialized culture, to convince mothers, or even give them the options of, would you want a son who's 6'4" and a good surgeon? Or would you want to take your chances that he might be the garbage man? This is the sort of thing that will work very, very well with a shopping-addicted culture. They shop for everything. You know, that's how things are now in the system. It's a sad system. And it wasn't designed to last forever the way it is. It was designed to go into this next phase. But society are ready for it. A lot of them are ready for it. And it would be interesting to watch it if we all live long enough to go through it. To watch it happening. And you will hear people coming out boasting about making godlike offspring. This godlike stuff is becoming really prevalent today. The ego is out of control with people. They believe all this stuff. They've really soaked up all this New Age stuff and godhood stuff. And that's the great delusion, the great folly. Even though every holy book, including the Vedas, doesn't promise that the bulk will come through. Well, if you're not an individual, then you're popular. Understand? An individual will not be popular. The populace like the popular. If you like the things of the world, you'll chat about the things of the world and they'll love you for it. But they don't realize there's so many of them who are now the New Age, they're becoming the main religion. And therefore, obviously, if only a minority come through, it won't be them, because they'll be the majority. It doesn't dawn on them. Hello, we have Ben in Wisconsin there. Are you there, Ben?
Hello, Alan.
How are you?
Doing well. I really love your work. I'd like to say that first off. Mm-hmm. Glad we have people like you out there doing what you're doing. My question for you is, are you familiar with a man by the name of Wilhelm Reich?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about him? I know he was heavily persecuted in multiple countries, including this one, where he died in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he claimed that he discovered this sort of light force, those orgasmic type force and so on, orgone and energy,
right,
and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But that was already coming out even as far back as the 30s. He copied the idea from science that was already being discussed back in the 30s and came up with that. Now, whether it was genuine or not, we'll never ever know. And personally, I'm very wary of people who come up with these technologies. Remember, it's the same thing too. In Blavatsky's day, they said they'd blend science with religion, and that's why the New Age religions use scientific terminology combined, trying to justify the validity of their religion. They're blending them. And it's the same thing with all healing today, that if you can heal anything, if we just get this new gadget or gizmo that sparks and all the rest of it, it's very impressive and gives a nice humming sound. Again, it's old hypnotic stuff. If you believe in it enough, it will work for a little while.
Sure.
But there's too many shysters come out over the years selling all kinds of stuff to sick and dying people. There's a lot of money being made off misery because people are desperate. You understand?
Yeah.
So just because they say and they claim things does not mean it's true.
Sure. And the reason I ask, sorry about that.
Yeah, it's the same with Reich. You see, it's the same sort of problem. You're stuck in this never land without the proof. You know?
He wrote a book that I thought he was right on with a lot of things, The Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
yeah, well, all societies are technically fascist.
Sure.
Even the communist ones were.
Sure. I guess that's why I'm asking, because a lot of what he claimed to discover seemed a little bit crazy to me, but a lot of his writing seemed right on also. So
yeah, So, but as I say, we'll never ever know, and I don't even waste my time with people who are put up there as mysteries to speculate about, because you can never get to the bottom of it.
Sure.
You know, it was the same with the Royal Rife machines. The ones that Rife had experimented with, and you can see the old footage on it, the old film footage, used big tubes, and that emitted tremendous light, almost like X-rays. Mm-hmm. Whereas the stuff they sell today, they don't use those tubes at all. They just attach a couple of electrodes to the body and claim that turning this frequency or that frequency will destroy Staphylococcus or whatever it happens to be. It's more a matter of faith, really, because I haven't met anyone yet who's been cured of anything.
Sure.
And I find that odd.
Yeah. I haven't done enough research on it to know, really.
Uh-huh.
One more guy I wanted to ask you about. I've been seeing this guy's artwork in a lot of places lately. Are you familiar with Alex Gray?
Yeah, uh-huh.
I'm going to get a Fed staff. It's hard to tell, but it looks pretty New Agey to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Again, all art too. I mean, see, whatever the guys at the top say art is, suddenly becomes trendy. The king has no clothes, works wonders with the followers. And I've known some top artists that were very good. I've also known people in art galleries, the big boys, that push certain cults or cultures of art or trends in art who are absolutely wacko. And they know too, they're kidding. They could tell you anything is art. And everyone near the top, all the pretenders, the wannabes will parrot it and say it's beautiful. It could be the ugliest thing you've ever seen. But that's the folly of humankind again. So they do use art to symbolize the kind of culture you're going into. And now we know that the nihilists movement in art, from Picasso onwards, and all these characters were paid by the West, by the way, to bring in a nihilistic culture with their art, stuff that could art that used to bond you to society with love and so on and high emotions. They brought in these cold works of arts that schizophrenic your society, made it schizoid, it split you apart, it gave you nothing to hold on to, and that was all a purpose-made trend so that they could start reshaping society and what values were. That's
you know, nihilist implies you believe in nothing, is that correct?
Nothing, yeah. Anything that was dear and near to humanity as a species was to be destroyed to kill off the old bonds. And just discussing how even art, all art, you see, are used to create a mindset amongst the populace that takes it on by osmosis. They don't really question, they simply adopt things. It's osmotically transferred into their minds that which is suddenly appears around them. And you have to go into different pieces to find out the meanings. And I'm not familiar with all these particular artists. I've seen some stuff, but I have to go into it in detail to find out if there's any other kind of messages there and being promoted there. What you do see now in these alternate realities, these cartoonish figures that they're bringing the children into these alternate realities with, where they'll eventually be hooked up to the internet, you know, like brain interfaces, they're giving them a what seems to be a perfection, very unreal. And I used to be, I wondered why the Soviet system, when I was young, was using a lot of cartoons to get messages across to the public. I thought, well, cartoons are so childish, but they went into it in a big, big way and sponsored a lot of artists to do the drawings, etc., for cartoon animations that always had a public moral content to shape society. And well, now we know that these cartoon figures now are used in these particular games and alternate realities. That was the purpose of it. Started a long, long time ago. And their characters have no flaws whatsoever. And you can actually make your own type of out of composites, make a composite of yourself, and make, design it the way that you want to be. Because in this society, you're taught not to like who you are. That's a very important part of the capitalization and culture that we live in, is it runs on making you feel unhappy with who you are. That's the whole point of it. If you were happy with who you are, you wouldn't be running off getting all the fancy hairdos and buying all the slick clothes to make yourself look different. It's all meant to that you're unhappy with who you are. And they've targeted no one as much as the female in the species, telling them that this is too small, that's too big, yada, 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 and just come and get this and buy that, and you'll be fine. And that's how commerce works. It exploits people. That's the bottom line. It's meant to exploit you. And they look at the Achilles heel of the female, the Achilles heel of the male, and they knew how to exploit either one of them. It's a science. And it works because we haven't changed our natures. And plus, in the society that we're raised in, we're taught not to really like ourselves as we are. Unless you're part of the group, like a little part of the jigsaw puzzle that fits in the big group out there, groupthink. Then you're a good citizen, and you'll fit into the new system quite well. It's sad how they've used the arts, though, down through the ages. And again, it's not new. If you look at the muses, you'll catch on to what it all means, if you understand what the muses are in old ancient mythology and how it can be used against the people to inculcate new values. Even if they're detrimental to yourself, you'll adopt them and you'll work them into being. Well, I hear the music, so that's it coming up for tonight from Hamish the Dog. And myself up here in Ontario, Canada, it's good night, and may your God or your gods go with you.